This is a really stellar panel. I'm on a panel with two of the world's leading experts on this topic, and I come to this issue a little more recently, and I'll get into that a little bit more as I get into my presentation. But what I'd like to start out with is to share a little bit of background on the work that I'm drawing from for my comments today. So as David and Sherry both mentioned early on, I'm from CNA, and we're an organization that supports the DOD and other national security entities with research and analysis. And about 10 years ago, as David mentioned earlier, Sherry founded the Military Advisory Board, a board of retired military officers who take on issues relating to security, to energy, climate, energy security, and more recently, water. The MAB, about a year ago, decided to explore the issue of the link between water stress and national security. And the driving question behind the research essentially is, does water stress globally matter for U.S. national security? And if so, how? And then finally, how do we think about what we can do about it? And the question is really directed at the national security enterprise, of which the DOD really sits at the center. So in terms of where we are in the research, we're moving into the stage where we're writing the report and really starting to pull together all of our findings. So what I'm presenting here today are some of our preliminary findings. I'm going to hit the wave tops, but I'm also looking at this event today as an opportunity to maybe solicit some feedbacks and comments from you all on where we are with our research and what we think as we finalize that. So unlike David and Marcus, as I mentioned, I come from this problem set from a little bit of a different vantage point. My background is really in military operations, conflict, and hard security. Most of the time, I'm spending supporting U.S. military on a range of operational issues and tactical issues as well, actually, related to conflict and in the Middle East and North Africa. So today, U.S. priorities in that part of the world are focused, as you all know, on counterterrorism and countering threats from groups like the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. And really what we know is that most of these groups and these threats are operating in areas where there is deep instability and/or are hot conflict zones. Incidentally, many of them are also experiencing the conditions of water stress. So my team has been looking a lot at these conflicts. And through our research, we've concluded that understanding and factoring in the root causes and underlying drivers of conflict and instability in this part of the world can lead to more effective approaches to dealing with them, both for the US and for our partners. So what really sparked my interest in this water work was, as I increasingly brief my work and share it with folks around, inevitably people will tell me that water stress is an important factor and we're not thinking about it right and we're not really appreciating that it is a factor in these conflicts. But most of the information that I get in my interactions and that we in the conflict world get are largely anecdotal. There's not a lot of hard research directed at our community on this topic and on this question. So that water and water stress could lead to conflict is a relatively unexplored notion, at least as far as I can tell, in the overall world of conflict studies and security studies, and within the DOD, I would even submit. Although there's implicit knowledge, people get it. Yes, it makes sense, but there's just not a lot of detail of how. When the rubber hits the road, how do these conditions lead to conflict? So part of the problem, I would submit, is that the media coverage on this topic can be a little ineffective. And I understand it's a very complex topic, and I get it, and that can be what part of the problem is. But there are a lot of articles out there with headlines warning of the coming water wars in country X or in region Y. But rarely do these articles take on the details. And unfortunately, or actually fortunately, many of these conflicts tend not to actually happen. A lot of the work is speculative, and so what it's created within, I would say, the community that I work in is a little bit of a boy who cried wolf situation. And unfortunately, this has led to some skepticism within the conflict, security, and defense world, with a lot of people dismissing claims of water leading to war as being alarmist. And so this is definitely a challenge that I believe all of us have to overcome in kind of breaking in and moving the needle in this community. All right, so I'm going to get my slide up here because we're here to talk about water conflict in the arc of stability. So this slide is basically just to show you that there are a number of conflicts taking place in the arc of instability. The red explosions indicate where there are civil wars, the yellow where there are current insurgencies, and then in the black I've highlighted where Al-Qaeda and Islamic State have a presence. So you really get a sense of there's a lot of conflict, a lot of instability taking place currently in this part of the world. So what are the takeaways from a picture like this? So first, we know that there are different types of conflicts, right? The conflicts and the type of conflicts that we're talking about in this part of the world are not major state-on-state wars. They're mostly internal conflicts, insurgencies, civil wars, terrorist organizations. Second, most of these conflicts involve violent non-state actors or proxy forces. Many involve governments and non-state actors competing or vying for the support and acquiescence of population, or they're trying to control physical territory and or control physical territory. And in most cases, the entities opposing the groups are trying to overthrow the government and replace it ultimately. That's the end goal. So drawing from the extensive work that my team has done on conflicts in this part of the world, we know the following. In all these cases, multiple, if not many, factors contributed to the realization of violent conflict. In no case was there a single factor. On the contrary, in all these cases, it's been a complex, messy mix of many different types of factors that unfolded each on their own unique timeline and ultimately produced a situation where people, groups, and governments resorted to violence. In some cases, as is the case in Syria, it engulfed the entire society. So I keep using the word factor. What do I mean by factor? In this case, I'm talking specifically about underlying economic, political, social, and increasingly ecological grievances that exist within a population or a community that over time get worse, are not addressed, or are compounded by other factors to a point where violence becomes the only perceived course of action to draw attention to the grievances or to address them. So to give you a little bit of real-life examples of these underlying causes, I'll draw from the Boko Haram situation. My team's done quite a bit of work on that conflict, and we have identified a long list of underlying grievances that have led to the insurgency in northeast Nigeria, among which are economic marginalization in that part of the country, unfair wealth distribution at the national level, high unemployment, terrible infrastructure, few economic opportunities. There is a history of violent extremism through which people use to express grievances and disappointment politically, endemic corruption, and then there's the issue of people movement, migration, internal displacement, which may not have been an underlying cause in why the conflict came about, but certainly has been an issue in its perpetuation. And similarly, we looked at Libya and we came up with a different set of grievances or root causes or underlying issues that have led to the situation in Libya today. So we point in that situation to a lack of political unity at the highest levels of government. It's a very fractured political polity. It's very regionalized. And so it's been very difficult to bring the country together. And it currently has three competing governments. There's also the issue in that country of migration. There's long been trading routes and smuggling routes that have gone through Libya. Those have been increasingly being used over time as folks from the Lake Chad Basin area are trying to move up through Libya into Europe. There's the long-term negative consequences of the oil economy in Libya, which has left an economic situation where there's not a whole lot of entrepreneurialism or opportunities for people. And again, in Libya, there's endemic corruption and nepotism. So those are the types of factors we're talking about in these types of conflicts. So the question for me and my team is, can and should we add water stress or crises relating to water to these list of factors? So I'm going to conclude here because I know I'm getting short on time. But first of all, I will say the answer is a resounding yes. Our research shows that it is a factor, and that as water stress gets worse, as it's projected to do, it will likely play an increasing role as a factor in instability and conflict. So there's evidence that water stress is a factor worth understanding for the national security community and DOD specifically. But let's unpeel the onion a little bit in terms of how. So we know it's not a straight line. There's little evidence that we've seen where water stress or its conditions, poof, lead to conflict. But what water stress and its conditions can do and tend to do is to add to act as an additional stressor or multiplier on top of pre-existing challenges that in many cases are also not being addressed. So when there are numerous existing underlying grievances, deep-seated issues that are not being addressed within a society, if you add water stress or the conditions of water stress on top, it can exacerbate the situation, raising the chances of instability and in some cases leading to violent conflict. In that way, we believe that water stress should be thought of as a factor in conflict. Water stress can also trigger events that may not be destabilizing themselves, but can lead to second and third order effects that are destabilizing. So for example, when populations move as a result of extended drought, for example, they move in usually to somebody else's area. And that can become a problem, particularly if there are pre-existing social or ethnic tensions, economic stress, resource shortages, and the list goes on and on. But that's when you can see when it becomes destabilizing. The migration in and of itself isn't a problem, but it triggers the second and third order effects that can be and often are. So I think Marcus talked about the Syria situation, and that's a difficult, complex case, and there's been great work by him and others done doing the forensics on that situation, looking back to 2007 and telling this complex story. But that case study, that story of Syria, highlights a lot of what we're talking about here, and I would submit that you could do the same for Yemen, Somalia, and probably more. I'm sure Iraq as well. So third, I would say a striking commonality among all of these conflicts in this part of the world is the absence of good governance. Like governance fail to address the other social, political, and economic woes within these societies, in many cases, they often fail to respond to water crises. In some cases, it may be simply that they're not aware that the crisis is taking place or that they don't appreciate how serious it is. And so that leads us to think about warning systems and understanding, and are there ways to help governments be able to detect when this has happened? Unfortunately, in other cases, it can be an issue of political will in areas that don't matter to central governments, because that can happen. And also, it could be a resource and capacity issue where they know it's happening, but they simply don't have the tools, the technology, the know-how to respond in a way to help. So my last point is really, I'm going to end on a question. I believe that when Sherry Rosenblum, who's the director of the MAB now, and I go out to share this work and our findings with folks in DOD and in the broader national security community, that I think I don't anticipate a lot of pushback on the story that we're telling and on the links that we're making, because it builds from a lot of the great work that people like Marcus and David have been doing and others like them. But what I do think the hard part, the really hard question, because Sherry asked us what the really hard question is, they're going to say, Julia, what do we do about it? And when you're talking to an organization like DOD, whose main mission is fighting wars, that becomes a difficult question. Now, I have some thoughts. We're pulling together thoughts, and we have some ideas for how to answer that question, but I'm thinking maybe that's something we can jump into in the Q&A a little bit in more depth. So thank you.
That was great, Julia. In fact, all the panelists were great, and I see that we already have hands going up. So I'm going to ask one question, and then I'm going to open it to the audience. Okay. So Marcus, David, and Julia, if you had 3 minutes, don't take 3 minutes now, but if you had 3 minutes to brief the president and the National Security Advisor on why they should care about water and security and what the U.S. should be doing about it in this administration, what are your top 3 points? Julia, how about if you tailor your recommendations to the Secretary of Defense?
I would just come at it from the counterterrorism perspective. And, you know, all the work that I've done in that area, I would submit that killing bad guys and working with partners to kill bad guys will only get us so far in this fight. And at some point, we're going to have to find effective measures to deal with some of these underlying things that are contributing to the types of environments that are allowing these types of groups to take hold. There's a lot of these things which, you know, the U.S. government doesn't have the ability to affect. We can't force the Nigerian government to distribute wealth equally. We're never going to win. We're never going to get anywhere on that. The water issue to me is interesting because it strikes me as fairly non-political, non-controversial. Everybody needs water. So to the extent that that can be explored as an area for partner capacity building or working with foreign partners, and the DoD has great relationships in this part of the world with military leaders, even if it's a vector for communicating the importance of this issue as a broader issue of stability for countries, I would submit that that is something that the DoD should consider looking at it like that.